This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
River in the sky, flowing by. River in the sky, all around the world. Sudden rainfall comes, it's a gusher. This never happened in my daddy's day. Nobody alive seen it like this. It's a gusher.
The atmospheric river that drenched British Columbia with record-breaking amounts of rain has also taken lives.
When rivers in the sky fall all at once, another atmospheric river just blasted the Pacific Northwest. Vancouver, Canada was hit by flooding in multiple suburbs, an emergency evacuation in nearby Deep Cove. For a city very used to rain, this was a crazy, record-fast downpour that washed away homes and killed at least two people. The surprise super-flooding in Appalachia with Hurricane Helene was possible because an atmospheric river accompanied that hurricane. That is a known connection. Another is La Niña, and we investigate all this in this program. Less known, atmospheric rivers are moving toward the poles, invading both the Arctic and Antarctica. That changes the ice world, and that changes everything. Later in the show, we talk with author and acknowledged expert Dr. Qinghua Ding. But first, let's spend a quick 14 minutes with the grand old man of coastal science, North Carolina scientist Dr. Orrin Pilkey. We talk about Appalachia and the safe haven that wasn't, and the danger we're all in.
This never happened in my daddy's day. Nobody alive seen it this way. It's a gusher.
There is a new book full of climate threats, of course, but also some new ideas to help you cope, not just governments, but you. It is called Escaping Nature, How to Survive Global Climate Change. The main author is Dr. Orrin H. Pilkey, Professor Emeritus of Earth and Ocean Sciences at Duke University. Dr. Pilkey founded much of what we know about coastal science. From North Carolina, Orrin Pilkey, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
I'm happy to be here.
Yes, we last talked in 2019 about the need to start withdrawing from the coastline. You gave us the old saying, if you can see the sea can see you. But now we see some awful death and damage in Appalachia. It seems like storms from the hot ocean can find places way up in the mountains. I did not expect this. Did you?
No, I definitely didn't expect it. In fact, I'm somewhat embarrassed to say that we had ranked as of the mountains of North Carolina be the best place to move, the safest place to move, as the atmosphere gets hotter, which is rapidly doing. And so that was our number one place, our number one haven, climate haven. And it turns out it got damaged. We based the statement of the classification on the heat problem. The heat in the mountains with elevation will not get oppressive as it will here in the coastal plain in Piedmont of southeastern U.S.
Do you have any stories of Hurricane Helene from your stomping grounds in the Carolinas?
We've had them in the past. Yes, of course. I'm in the Piedmont, which is quite a ways away from the ocean, but nothing of in the immediate past, nothing of the magnitude that we've seen here. My parents, who retired in Mississippi in 1969, got their house was basically destroyed by hurricanes, two of them, Hurricane Camille and at first, and then Hurricane Katrina later. They had 6 feet of water in the house in Camille, and they successfully escaped from it. But when Hurricane Katrina came with a 30-foot storm surge, the house was destroyed completely. However, they had moved by that time. They had moved to Charlottesville, Virginia, luckily.
So we do get news reports about the homes and lives wrecked, but nothing about hurricane damage to nature. With your specialty, can hurricanes damage coasts? I mean, do they speed up coastal erosion, for example?
Hurricane damage is so widespread, it often isn't even recognized, considering the fact that the sea level is rising because of climate change and the fact that the hurricanes will be more powerful because the oceans are warmer. And they'll have more rain because the oceans are warmer, and so on and so on. It goes. We're in for a future of pretty significant increase in hurricanes, both in frequency and especially in power. So it's a very serious thing for those folks who live close to the ocean.
And I read in the book, too, that speaking of big winds, that there was also evidence that increasing greenhouse gases will change the behavior of tornadoes in the U.S.
It's a little less clear, I think, the impact on tornadoes, but it's no question it is going to increase the number of tornadoes. And some of the tornadoes will be associated, of course, with hurricanes.
Your book also covers climate and health, a lot about heat, of course, but there was one odd thing that caught my eye. Most medical experts do not expect human breathing problems until carbon dioxide reaches at least 1,000 parts per million in the atmosphere. And in 2024, we topped out around half of that, 426 parts per million. So do you recall why your team says increasing CO2 might even affect our cognitive abilities when it builds up indoors? I read in your book that if there's more CO2 outdoors as it goes up, there may be more CO2 build up indoors, and that's when it could affect our cognitive abilities.
Yes, that has been, shall I say, demonstrated fairly well, and it is something that we really have to be aware of that possibility. The solution to that, of course, is to get rid of the CO2 source, whatever that is, in your house. But it's a significant possibility. I don't think it's a major thing right now, but I think it has a chance, like so much else with climate change, a chance of getting worse in the future.
Well, the things that are happening right now is extreme heat. Just recently, Phoenix, the state of Nevada, parts of Texas set all-time October temperature records. One of my hometowns of Toronto, Ontario, was 78 degrees today, pretty warm down through the southeast again in late October for Halloween. Oren Pilkey, how would you describe the future of heat? What's coming?
Well, that's a major part of climate change. We anticipate that in North America that the heat, maybe in the central part of the continent, it will continue to increase as long as we don't do something about the emissions that we're providing the atmosphere. The heat is going to get worse. And it's going to get to the point where some parts of North America will be unlivable. And that goes for parts of North Carolina where I'm living right now. And the suggestion of climatologists is that in order to avoid this extreme heat, we have to go north or we have to go up. Either one would avoid the extreme heat. That's why we had recommended the mountains of North Carolina as a good place to move before the hurricane came. The recommendation is we should move 45 degrees north or higher for the ideal situation, that for a much better situation than we have here. And that the 45 degree north line is approximately a line from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine. Ideally, to avoid what's coming if we don't do something about emissions. That's the line to move to. As long as you got an air-conditioned home, of course, you can exist anywhere, but that eventually you're going to work outside. Eventually, the power is going to go out and so forth. So this is a very serious possibility, probability that's going to happen with climate change.
You know, most ecologists say we have to go back to nature or at least emulate her sustainable ways. Why does your book title suggest escaping nature?
Because nature is being impacted so heavily by climate change. I mean, climate change is part of nature, and we don't escape nature always, everywhere, everything, but we have to treat nature, look at it so different now because of the climate changes. We can't make the same assumptions we've always been making about weather and danger of flooding and so forth. Predictability is different now, and it's going to get more different than in the past. Basically, what we mean by escaping nature is we're not going to leave nature, but nature's going to be different. We have to recognize that.
Yes, it seems like in warming weather we have the tropical West Nile virus popping up in New England. Your book suggests Burmese pythons may spread across the American South. It sounds like a whole new landscape of critters is coming with climate change, and not all of them are friendly. What do you see coming as far as the wildlife in their changes with climate change?
Well, climate change will have positive impacts on some animals and negative impacts on others, obviously. The python, that figure that we have in the book, is based basically on temperature, and but of course some of the marshes and swamps further north will still be suitable for the python, presumably. But that may be a little bit of a longer study. I'm not sure we worry about the python, but there's a lot of other things that we could be worrying about. I think the way I look at it is that we have to escape some of the changes that are being made.
It's strange because we have escaped nature by our own actions, by changing the atmosphere and all the things that come from that. And yet we also have to escape this new and very dangerous nature, for us at least, as humans, as we go along. And yet you and your team are not counting on government action. In fact, you say for now people have to, quote, fend for themselves. Why don't you join the throng of experts who just map out big plans for big governments? This book seems to go more direct to the readers.
What we're doing to change the amount of CO2 and so forth, the emissions that we're putting into the atmosphere, we have just scratched the surface. You know, we have a lot of solar panels, we've got a lot of windmills, but yet the temperature's going up, the CO2, the emissions are continuing to increase, almost unaffected by what we're doing. Maybe we can look at something like our space program, where we put so much into getting to the moon and getting to Mars and so forth, spending billions of dollars. And there's a great deal of support for that program. But here, when we're going and looking at space, we're looking at a new situation in Kari. But here, back home, we're already in trouble. We're already in serious trouble. The best statement I've heard regarding it, I think, is by the UN Secretary Antonio Guterres. Says, this isn't quite the way he said it. We're heading toward a climate disaster with our foot still on the accelerator. Such an important viewpoint. We really are still increasing the problem. We have not gotten into the gist of this problem yet. we haven't made the effort that we need, that we haven't put in the money that we need to really make a change.
The new book is Escaping Nature, How to Survive Global Climate Change. It's a big book, and we didn't even get to the fascinating photos. I spent a lot of time looking at photos in this book, and there's a long list of helpful resources in print and that you can find online. The major author and team leader is Dr. Oren Pilkey. He's the Professor Emeritus of Earth and Ocean Sciences at Duke University. Oren, thank you for this book, and thanks for spending time again with our listeners.
This is my pleasure, and I hope we've made some impact, some understanding that the problem is with us and it's getting worse, and we still have our foot on the accelerator. I'm 90 as of 3 days ago.
I'm heading towards 80. I'm not there yet. You just celebrated your 90th. We're probably not going to live till 2040 or 2060 to see whether these climate predictions come true. Why are we still doing this so passionately, Oren?
That's a very good question. I like to think it's because we have children and grandchildren, and I even have a great-granddaughter. And I know that I'm concerned for their future. I feel that with my age, I have enough experience and viewpoint that's got a lot of information behind it that I can do this well, and I should take advantage of it. But I'm not doing it anymore because I'll get an advance in rank or get more money. That's a different matter now. I'm no longer into that game.
Well, I'm not doing it for the money either. I give the whole show away for free all over the world. So I'm glad we're still on the same page. Thanks a lot for talking with me. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Can I just say other things are going on in the world beside the American election? Important things. The United Nations Environment Program just warned this world is currently heading towards more than 3 degrees centigrade global warming. Only immediate slashing greenhouse gas emissions this year could keep us below even 3 degrees. You know 3 degrees is beyond catastrophe for this civilization and most species, like mammals and eventually a lot of sea life. It is not dangerous. It is final. That sounds important. Also, there are three major international conferences this and next month where the world tries to grapple with disappearing species, climate change, and expanding deserts. Only one nation in the world was not part of the UN Biodiversity Conference, called COP16. The United States has never ratified the One World Treaty to protect the last of wildlife and living systems.
The time of words is over. We know what the problem is. There have been lots of conferences about it, lots of meetings, lots of declarations, but now what we need is action.
These conferences will not stop the fossil fuel titans or our addicted populations from accelerating climate change. Perhaps they can shape a vision of how we can do better, but is that enough? I look forward to that debate on major networks instead of the endless soap opera of American elections. By the way, other countries hold elections, and they do it from announcement to final results in just weeks. In ancient Byzantium, we're talking the years 800 or 900 of our common era, it was first known as New Rome. The citizens were divided into two competitive teams, the Blues and the Greens. These teams, if you call them that, were part politics, part sports, and part ranting and violence. History repeats in country after country these days. We just had an election in our neck of the woods where, more than 1 week later, I still don't know who will be our next government. The vote was almost exactly divided between polar extremes on the left and the right. Europe is going through similar things, and America, well, that's the famous example. Dictatorship waits in the wings. This may be intentional, driven by other nations or gangs wanting to weaken their opponents, or it may be just a stage of civilization in decline. Either way, while we battle each other, the natural ground we stand on, the water we drink, the temperature, survival, everything is changing under our feet. Pay attention to the news from the real world, the planet that can live without us. As you heard, one of those alerts from the natural world is freak extreme rainfall events all over the world. Every day we see new videos of a city somewhere in the world submerged by raging floodwaters. Not all of these are associated with atmospheric rivers. Other kinds of fronts and storms can bring fast rain floods. But many historic, mind-boggling, extreme rains, like a foot, 2 or 3 feet, up to a meter in 24 hours, arrive with atmospheric rivers that can last for days. Here is how Wikipedia describes atmospheric river. The term was originally coined by researchers Reginald Newald and Yong Zhu of Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the early 1990s. It was to reflect the narrowness of the moisture plumes involved. Atmospheric rivers are typically several thousand kilometers long and only a few hundred kilometers wide. And a single one can carry a greater flux of water than Earth's largest river, the Amazon River. There are typically 3 to 5 of these narrow plumes present within a hemisphere at any given time. These have been increasing in intensity slightly over the past century, end quote from Wikipedia. According to one source, the American Meteorological Society started using the term atmospheric river in 2017. Television weather reporters only recently started reporting them, although so-called Pineapple Express was used to describe wet storms hitting California in the past. Unless you are in college now, you never learned about them in school. The whole large-scale damaging phenomenon is still a new frontier in atmospheric science, but a brutal reality already in many countries. Not everywhere is vulnerable. The interior of continents and very dry places are generally exempt from atmospheric rivers. ARs do strike anywhere hurricanes can form, but also in places that seldom see tropical storms. For example, Vancouver, Canada, the recent target of the Sky River downfall, only experienced one tropical cyclone in records, or hurricane, since the records began, and that was Typhoon Frida in 1962. Atmospheric rivers have been reported in the United States, of course, and Canada, New Zealand, the UK, Portugal, and Spain, Southeast Asia, like the Philippines and Indonesia, and the coast of Chile. They also hit Antarctica and the Arctic. More about that to come. Atmospheric rivers can be beneficial, providing up to half the water California requires, including for its famous agriculture. Some cause major landscape damages, though, including landslides, broken highways, and countless flooded homes and farms. Strangely, the most deadly atmospheric rivers on record happened in California in 1862, and then in British Columbia, Canada, in November 2021 and this October 2024.
Let's go to the pole when it gets too hot down here. Let's go to the pole and see what is going on.
But look beyond our narrow world. These sky rivers are pushing big changes at both poles. In March 2022, East Antarctica experienced an intense heat wave driven by the most powerful atmospheric river ever recorded over the region. Temperatures soared up to 40 degrees C, that's 104 Fahrenheit, above normal. The heat wave affected an area the size of India and led to significant ice melt. But our guest, expert King Hua Ding, cautions, we do not know if that one was caused by climate change, partly because our records at the South Pole are so short. We might be missing some established long-term cycle. But his science can show atmospheric rivers are going toward the poles more often. Up to a third of all rainfall reaching the Arctic in a year is delivered in just a few days during the arrival of atmospheric rivers. I find that amazing. Polar rainfall can speed glacial reduction and certainly pushes a decline in sea ice. We know declining sea ice reflects less solar energy, adding to more warming, which increases the moisture capacity of the atmosphere, leading to more and more powerful atmospheric rivers. That feedback is already in motion. Let me tell you about two more important connections. The development of atmospheric rivers is linked to the state of the ocean cycle called ENSO, known to the public as either La Niña or El Niño. We just came out of a single El Niño year, which discourages the formation of atmospheric rivers. The arrival of another major AR on the Pacific North Coast is another sign of this La Niña year being born. ENSO is a natural cycle in the eastern Pacific Ocean. Very New Science, released October 24th in the Proceedings of the National Academy, finds this oscillation of La Niña and El Niño has been going on for at least 250 million years. In previous ages, the two states hit extremes we have not seen. Whether that will be tripped by global warming and start again, we do not know. We also know that climate change may alter the patterns of La Niña and El Niño. I have seen different results and predictions. The essential point for now, the ENSO state is a major factor determining when atmospheric rivers can form. The second connection, atmospheric rivers may accompany tropical cyclones or not. Each can form separately, but there is solid science showing they are fellow travelers. An atmospheric river accompanied Hurricane Helene and is likely the cause of the flooding that struck the former climate haven of North Carolina and nearby states. Several days of heavy rain saturated the ground before Helene arrived and continued during the storm's passing. Atmospheric rivers are part of that deadly tragedy as much as the hurricane itself. That is another reason we all need to learn more about them. Meteorologists and media weather reporters are getting on this. They are warning the public. You and I, and everyone we know, need to learn about extreme rainfall events and how our actions or inaction are certain to make these flood events worse and more common. There are limits to how much we can change the atmosphere and survive. Heat is just one limit. The whole water cycle, from the ocean to the ground to all living things, is another big limit, crying for attention. Here is our expert scientist interview. Then I will follow with a quick summary, because this is tricky stuff for we who are not scientists.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Scientists predict the Arctic will get wetter as the planet warms. You've probably heard that. But this is no gentle change. A short burst of heavy rains in a storm over Greenland a few years ago ended up raising global sea levels by 1.2 millimeters. New Science finds extreme water vapor gets to the Arctic in atmospheric rivers. A wetter Arctic changes everything, from ice melt and permafrost thaw through changes to plants and animal life. Qinghua Ding is a climate scientist and associate professor at University of California, Santa Barbara. Dr. Ding specializes in large-scale prediction of change with a focus on the Arctic and the Antarctic. He co-authored the new paper, Role of Atmospheric Rivers in Shaping Long-Term Arctic Moisture Variability. From California, Qinghua Ding, welcome.
Thank you.
What is an atmospheric river, and how do they get to the Arctic?
Atmospheric river, by its name, you can see that it's like the river in the underground, but it exists. It operates in the atmosphere, so you can think it's just like a plume of the water vapor, and propagate or transport in the atmosphere, and mostly above the ground, like the. The strongest intensity of this phenomenon, normally we see just like a few hundred meters above the ground and to something like a few like 1,000 meters above ground because of the gravity, and because the gravity of the Earth and the water vapor still try to stay close as possible to the Earth's surface. And we know the air can hold a moisture, right? But the air is not stable, or the air move around by the wind, driven by the wind. So if the wind or air blow from somewhere to other place, air can hold a moisture. And this, if there is a very strong intensity or a clustering effect of this like a moisture, they form like a river on the land surface, something like that. And why to move towards the Arctic is a very interesting question. Climatologically, that means that in the mean state, the moisture transport from the tropical region to the polar region, okay, especially in the summertime. Because we know the tropical, climatologically, tropical is warmer than the polar region, right? And a warm air can hold more moisture. So more moisture in the tropical region, we know that, right? And less moisture in the polar region, like in the Arctic and Antarctica. And climatologically, there is many, many way to transport this moisture from the tropical region to the polar, and due to this weather effect. Think about a weather effect. Weather effect is like the rotation wind, right? Rotation wind just means that if there's a rotation, there's a rotation system, you can think like a clock. If a wind rotates like a clock or anti-clock, anti-clockwise, most of the weather system rotate like the anti-clockwise. And if a wing rotate like anti-clockwise, the two sides of the rotation is the opposite direction. One, think about an anti-clockwise rotation, right? To the right of this clock, the wing blow from the south to the north. And to the west, to the left part of this clock is the turn, the wing blow from the north to south. So this system to the right and try to blow or bring moisture from a lower latitude, that is our tropic, to a polar region. And but to the right, to the left, and bring the cold air from the polar region back to the tropical region. So this type of thing just play key role to mix the temperature gradient or mix the cold air and the warm air between the two areas, tropical region and the polar region. So this is a climatological phenomenon. But over the past 40 years or past a decade, we find more and more this system move toward like Arctic region and carry more moisture to the Arctic and change the local climate system. The goal of this study is not to only just review or just like a present this phenomenon, but the main point is to find or give an answer to explain why this phenomenon has happened just since like the 2000. So our main finding is that it's probably due to the like a complex combined factors.
We know atmospheric rivers can appear in the winter Arctic. Why did your study focus on summer months?
I know it's hard to understand, but you can think of it this way. The atmosphere is very complex. It's not always operate like the chaotic feature. Right? Sometimes, like 10 years, 20 years, the collision could be show some very different feature than the 20 years ago. And this change may not totally due to the CO2 forces. It could be due to something else. That's what we call it a low frequency. Low frequency means the variation longer than decades, okay? This type of thing also exists in our climate system. And even there's a wind pattern change over very long time scale, like the longer than 10 years, 20 years, or 30 years, there's a circulation wind pattern can steer or channel more air to the Arctic over very specific reasons. Yeah, so that is our main contribution of this study to the community, just to argue that recent change in the air or recent change of the moisture partially due to something internally driven rather than totally driven by the global warming.
Right, so you're not saying that all this increased moisture is necessarily due to human-made climate change. There could be other internal factors. Is that right?
So we find maybe 30-40% of this moisture trend over the past 30 years, 40 years, could be due to this internal variability. So that means another 50% or 60% is due to the man-made global warming effect, a move into the Arctic. So that favored increasing trend of moisture there. But to the right, or to the east of this dome, which is mainly over like the over the North Atlantic part. So that is the place we see some less air intrusion into the Arctic. So that means less and less air move into the Arctic over that part. So there's like a dipole structure because it is a heat dome structure. So we call this like the circulation wind pattern. And this pattern cannot be well reflected by the model of fossil CO2 because the model for fossil CO2 that favors very uniform circulation pattern. Doesn't favor this type of doesn't favor the generation of this type of a heat dome structure.
Your paper does take a close look at impacts of ARs on Greenland, and I'm glad you just explained that sort of sitting heat dome that can appear for a few years. Why is it so important to know what happens with atmospheric rivers on Greenland?
I think the main thing is that we open a new door to look at some like the cross time scale interaction, because we know the AR is a very short time scale phenomenon. As we said in the abstract, usually AR is believed as some like a chaotic feature, just like the randomness or just like a random feature, like a weather activity. So we don't think the AR should show some like a well-organized pattern. But by our study, we see the large-scale circulation pattern play like the low-frequency variability, but it's a low-frequency variability have some like the cascading effect to the faster process, like a weather system, like AR. And there's some like the interaction across the time scale. And this cross time scale interaction may amplify something we don't know before. So we think that probably in the future we will explore more how there's the cross time scale interaction between the low frequency variability and the short time scale variability, how they work together to amplify or regulate the warming process in the Arctic or the place near Greenland.
In the news, incidents of a month's worth of rain in hours are popping up all over, from Toronto, Canada, to Connecticut, to the Alps and China. Are atmospheric rivers and extreme rainfall events different? Do sudden extreme rains require an atmospheric river? Are atmospheric rivers and extreme rainfall events different, or do sudden extreme rains require an atmospheric river?
Most of the time, the AR, we talk about AR is the wintertime phenomenon. And because during wintertime, the weather, like a storm, is stronger. And the wind, so you can think of it this way. The AR needs two components. One thing is a storm. The second one is the water supply. If the two things both exist, the two things satisfy the need, and the AR can be generated. And if we only have a storm, that means a strong wind, without like the moisture supply from the lower latitude, we don't see strong AR. We only see the strong wind, like the regular extratropical storm. But if we only see the moisture supply but no wind, so we just see purely like the humid day and without a strong weather activity, because the storm can generate upper or downward motion and favor the formation of a cloud or favor the formation of the precipitation event. So we need two conditions, strong rotation or something like a strong, like a storm. The second one is the moisture supply. And we can discuss your question, that is what is the connection between the regular AR or strong AR with the extreme precipitation event over different regions of the globe. I think the continent we think the people find but not my study, based on other people's study, I read some study in the past month. It seems like over some places, like China, East Asia, or some part of the North America, 50% of the extreme precipitation is due to AR. But this number may be changed. But basically, we can find the majority of the extreme precipitation event is due to the AR event, and so that's why we should spend more effort to understand how AR respond to global warming in the future, or how AR respond to the both global warming and the future change of internal variability in the next decade to come. because we know the AR change will induce a change for extreme precipitation, and the extreme precipitation event will change the change in the other cycle, like hydrological cycle or the oil disaster for the ecosystem or for our everyday life. Yeah.
And there are a lot of other changes going on in the Arctic. For example, a 2023 paper led by Zhang Dong Zhang found that the paper title is Arctic Cyclones Have Become More Intense and Longer Lived Over the Past 7 Decades. And we had the Europeans flying aircraft into Arctic cyclones in the summer of 2022. So I was wondering, is there a relationship between your work on atmospheric rivers and increasing Arctic cyclones?
Yeah, I think so. As I said, just like an AR, cyclone is the part of the AR, but the AR requires moisture also. So if a more cyclone and a long-lived cyclone or lifespan cyclone is longer, the longer lifespan cyclone means that the cyclone is not a stationary. Cyclone always move around. So if the cyclone can survive longer in the Arctic, that means it can propagate longer and go deeper somewhere. And so I think this consistent study. So we maybe looked at the same thing from different angle, and we looked at some more like the joint impact of the cyclone combined with the moisture supply. But that is Zhudong's study maybe only focused on the one other aspect of this. Like a low pressure system. Yes, I think the both agree on the same thing. That is, the recent 10 years, 20 years, some substantial thing has changed in the Arctic. That is not reflected in a one time scale, just like the short time scale, but also maybe reflected in a low frequency time scale, just like a decade to decade stuff.
Can you tell us about the moisture feedback relationship between water vapor in the Arctic and the loss of ice on both sea and land? Just an introduction. How does that work?
Yeah, so you can think like that way, because in the Arctic, we talk about Arctic amplification. We always talk about the feedback process. There's so many feedback processes in the Arctic. So the most important thing is that we know that albedo, radiation albedo feedback. That is the pretty straightforward thing. Because I teach in my class, and many students can easily understand that. It's like when the ice, when there's an initial warming, ice melt, the either land ice or sea ice. And if the ice is a white color, right? Once the ice is melted, and the bare land or the ocean just exposed to the sun and absorb more radiation. So it favors the further warming. So this is the very basic feedback. But another one is that we call moisture feedback. And this moisture feedback means that when the air gets warmer, air can hold more moisture, and we know the water vapor is a very powerful greenhouse gas. And if air can hold more moisture, and the moisture is a very powerful greenhouse gas, so more moisture favors more global warming, and we also, this process also kick off the loop and favor further warming. So people think that in the future, if Arctica become warmer a little bit initially, then the air can start to hold more moisture, and this more moisture favor more global warming effect because it is the greenhouse effect. Then we will go something much, much faster warming process started, will be started. So we call this type of thing like the moisture, water moisture feedback.
At the other end of the Earth, this year Antarctica experienced a prolonged heat wave during its winter months, including the second warmest July ever recorded. What do you make of this?
Yeah, that's a good point, because the polar region is pretty sensitive. But July is the winter time for the Antarctica, right? And this type of thing, I don't think that it's necessarily connected to the anthropogenic faulting. I think that many of these things we observe may still partially due to the natural variability. And why we didn't observe these things a long time, like a decade ago, the reason is that we didn't have a good observation data that time, but now we have a really good global coverage of the both Antarctic and Arctic. You know, for the satellite data, like 1980s data have a big, like black hole in the deep Arctic. So that means that the coverage can only reach to like 85 degrees. Okay, after like 1985, and the satellite can cover or the Arctic. So same thing for the Antarctic. That's like the like even 20 years, 30 years ago, our satellite coverage cannot reach to the like the South Pole. So we have a pretty good coverage, and our satellite instrument is much better, and many channel, and can cover different variable. And another thing is that I have to see like the global warming still favor like the tropical more active, because the tropical is warmer than like a 1 degree, like a warmer than like a 20 years ago. And this, the tropical become warmer, may make the tropical belt a little bit expanded. Okay, this expansion is not like the very large, but it still have like a few degree expansion. Just a few degree expansion, the tropical belt maybe can send some signal to the extratropical region, like the Arctic, Antarctica. So some signal in the Antarctica may reflect some change in the tropical region due to the many different process. People still work on that. There are so many ways to explain the connection. So I think it's still hard to say this year event, like the July heat wave event, is necessary due to the anthropogenic faulting, but we cannot rule out the contribution from anthropogenic faulting to this individual event. We need to keep eyes on the similar thing in the future. And to after many years data, maybe we can find if there's a trend or not. And we can try to understand at least the cause of this behind the change. Yeah, I think it's still too early to say it's the cause of this year's event. Yeah, it's still possible due to the internal variability. But we cannot rule out the possibility because of the anthropogenic faulting.
Just as a member of the public, if I see something like that on Twitter, that there's a heat wave in Antarctica in the wintertime, I go, oh my God, this is global warming. But you're saying, well, no, take a little bit of caution here. We don't know what it's been doing.
Because it's only one event, we cannot see too much, right? So it's still too early. So let's wait for some more time to see. It's only individual event, or we have seen some like the systematic trend in the next like a decade to see the similar thing. Like every winter, more and more heat wave occurrence there, or nothing happened in the future. So yeah, I'm pretty cautious people, and I want to wait more data to support any argument we try to raise to explain the phenomena.
Okay, so as we wrap up here, I'd like you to talk to us about the questions that are left to answer. What needs more research, and what are you looking at next?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. Even I ask myself, because I'm not a mid-career scientist, so I also ask myself this similar question many times in the past year. So I think my main goal is to have a better future prediction or projection of the polar climate, or maybe the global climate overall, rather than the polar region. So the point is that we know our model is good, but not perfect. And how to improve model, there are so many ways, but I don't know which way is good because we have a very limited resources. And what is the best strategy to improve model in order to get a better projection of a future climate is my main goal. And my main the aim of my future research. And I think the one way for me pretty clear is that we should better understand the interaction between the anthropogenic faulting and internal variability, because we know internal variability is also a critical part of the climate system. Even in the next decade, we cannot say that in the next decade, internal variability doesn't matter, and everything is due to the anthropogenic faulting. We still have to see that maybe internal variability still plays some role in the future, but we don't know how. And another thing we don't know is that how the anthropogenic faulting interact with this internal variability. Because as I said, internal variability could be strengthened, or could be masked, or just offset the signal due to the anthropogenic faulting. So we need to know both. And we want our model can capture both. So this is my main goal in the future, to improve our understanding or improve our future projection of the global climate, especially in the polar region.
From UC Santa Barbara, we've been speaking with Professor King Hua Ding, And you can look for his open access paper in Nature Communications. Its title is Role of Atmospheric Rivers in Shaping Long-Term Arctic Moisture Availability. As always, you can find links to all the science and news we just talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. King Hua, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thank you, Verb.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
River in the sky, all around the world. Sudden rainfall comes, it's a gusher, gusher. It's a gusher, flood it out, it's a gusher.
This new study published in Science Advances shows, quote, atmospheric rivers have shifted about 6 to 10 degrees toward the two poles over the last four decades. This paper also illuminates a blind spot in our science, institutions, and our personal understanding of what to expect as the climate shifts. Almost all the governments and studies examine trends over decades and plan accordingly. You are shown trend lines on a graph rising steadily, sometimes for 100 years. But in reality, short, violent bursts are more important agents of change. A hurricane traveling with an atmospheric river or a tornado do not appear on climate models. Extreme heat and extreme rain are all averaged out. We need to focus on extreme events more than trends. Somehow, perhaps with artificial intelligence help, models and predictions used by weathercasters need to become more fine-grained, enough to show and include the impacts of, say, 2 months of rain in 24 hours, or deadly heat over 4 days. We don't have that yet. Averages and 10-year trends distort and underestimate the true risks of climate change. To find out more about damaging connections between atmospheric rivers and Arctic ice, check out my interview with Dr. Pengfei Zhang, posted March 1st, 2023 at ecoshock.org. In that astounding science, Dr. Zhang and colleagues find airborne torrents are reaching all the way to the Arctic Sea. They weaken Arctic sea ice in winter, and that changes weather all over the Northern Hemisphere. This paper by Zhang and colleagues also points to possibilities of abrupt climate change. As co-author L. Ruby Leung said in a press release, "We often think that Arctic sea ice decline is a gradual process due to gradual forcings like global warming. This study is important in that it finds that sea ice decline is due to episodic extreme weather events, atmospheric rivers." Look for the paper, More Frequent Atmospheric Rivers, Slow Seasonal Recovery of Arctic Sea Ice, published in Nature Climate Change, February 6, 2023. Of course, I'll put a link to that paper and the audio for the interview in my show blog this week at ecoshock.org. We talked about the poles, but it is obviously not just the poles getting water shock treatment. In February 2020, worrying floods accompanied Storm Dennis, causing record-breaking rainfall across parts of the UK, especially in South Wales. Some areas saw more than a month's worth of rain in just 48 hours, and that is in rainy Britain. An article in New Scientist finds, quote, "Atmospheric rivers that wind their way through the skies have been linked to 10 of the largest winter floods in the UK since the 1970s, end quote. In 2024, it's already to the point where some crops are ruined in the United Kingdom by persistent heavy rains. Fields are flooded, tractors are bogged down. As warming powers more intense rains, hopes for the UK to feed itself dwindle. Atmospheric rivers have become a new threat to UK food security for sure. They already overwhelm storm sewer systems built 100 years ago for a climate that no longer exists. Costs for adaptation are enormous, as are insurance bills and government emergency spending. Following the 2020 storms, the UK government announced over £5 billion to better protect 336,000 properties in England against flooding, all to be done by 2027. That is probably a tiny minor amount to refitting older infrastructure for this new wet climate, where extreme events become the norm. Next week, we tackle one of the largest and scariest changes looming in a warming world. Serious scientists are out there talking loudly over many channels, warning the North Atlantic overturning circulation could stop. Called AMOC, this great current is already weakening, as shown in scientific studies and observations. I've done interviews about that, links in my blog. The impacts are almost too big to imagine. The UK would lose its warming current, dropping up to 10 degrees C, falling to the climate of mid-northern Canada. Ireland gets a cold punch in the face. Scotland and most of Scandinavia would return to near-glacial conditions if the AMOC stops, and this could happen within the next 10 years or the next 40 years. We don't know. North Europe becomes uncomfortably cold, even while Sahara-like heat will plague southern countries like Italy and Spain due to ongoing warming. The continent could be split into hot and cold zones. I suppose the Alps would be the intermediaries? Join us next week for a journey into what it all means. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Thank you for listening and caring about what happens to this world.
Canadian scientist Paul Beckwith on the real big one for California, the Arc Storm Atmospheric River. From YouTube, check www.paulbeckwith.net.
This is the Arc Storm scenario. So they modeled the U.S. West Coast being hit in the winter by these atmospheric rivers that caused massive and devastating flooding. Arc Storm was the second full scenario. So the first one was an earthquake. They had a shakeout simulation on major earthquake, and then Arc Storm is named for an atmospheric river, AR, a one in a thousand year storm, a mega storm scenario. This scenario is based on repeated historical events that are documented in geologic and historical records. Okay, so the last one was the devastated California was in 1861 to 62. And can this happen again? And what would happen if it happens again? And they found here, megastorms are California's other big one. Okay, we all know about the big one, the concern for the big one, but a severe California winter storm could flood thousands of square miles of urban and agricultural land, resulting in thousands of landslides, disrupt lifelines throughout the state for days or weeks, and cost on the order of $725 billion. This flooding is unfathomable. 25% of the buildings in the state could have some degree of flooding in a single severe storm.
It's a gusher.